Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's a very great pleasure to be here with you. This is the second trip my wife and I have made to Australia. The last was in 1988. And I think at that time, toward the end of our trip, I intended to say something nice to the Australians who had been so kind to us when we were here. And I'm afraid I may have ended up alienating some of them at the time. So it's a great relief that to be asked back this time. What I said to them that I intended to be complimentary and which I'm afraid was alienating was that the Australians reminded me more of Americans than any other people I'd met anywhere. There is a bit of advice given to speakers, which is that all talks should have a beginning, a middle, and an end. I'm sure you all have heard that, haven't you? That bit of advice. I wonder if you know the reason for it, however. I thought not. That's an esoteric bit of information. Let me pass it on to you. Every talk needs a beginning, which is designed, in fact, for the presenter. It enables her to get off the stage and out of the light. Every talk needs to have a middle because that's for the speaker. It allows him to rabbit on for a long while about something of interest to him. And every talk has to have an end. That's for the audience. In addition, it is often said that in the beginning, one ought to tell the audience what you're going to talk about, and then in the middle, tell them what it is you're saying about it, and then at the end, tell them what it is you have said. That's to be sure they manage to survive your inarticulateness. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to follow that pattern. My beginning, then, is to tell you what I'm going to talk about this afternoon. Joy mentioned the title, which is The Ancient Wisdom and the Information Superhighway. Particularly what I'm going to talk about is what the ancient wisdom is and what modern theosophy is, how they're alike and how they're different. And in doing so, in making this comparison and contrast, I'm going to mention three great archetypal symbols. Two of them are traditional ones. One of those traditional ones is the cosmos as a gigantic person, and the other is the cosmos as a gigantic machine. The new symbol, the new archetypal symbol I'm going to mention, is the cosmos as a computer network, the information superhighway. That's the beginning. Now the middle. Theosophy tells us that there has been something we sometimes call the ancient wisdom, which has been with us since the dawn of time. This is the accumulated wisdom of the human race. H.P. Blavatsky speaks of this in the introductory chapter to the third volume of her great work, The Secret Doctrine. This is what she says. You'll have to listen very carefully. In fact, here I'm going to be a little bit like an American poet by the name of Robert Frost. Are any of you familiar with Robert Frost's poetry? He was a New England poet. And Robert Frost used to come. Nobody who lives in New England wants to stay there during the winter if they can possibly get out. And Robert Frost used to come south every winter to visit a daughter of his who lived in Florida. And in order to pay for his trip south, his winter trips, he used to stop at all of the universities along his route and give poetry readings. And very charming readings there were, too. And he would be reading one of his poems, and he'd come to a place he particularly liked, and he would stop in the middle of the poem and say, "Now, listen very carefully to the next line," and then go on. So listen very carefully to this next line from H.P. Blavatsky. She says, "One of the main points of this volume is to indicate, in the works of the old Vedic, Greek, and other philosophers of note, as well as in all the world's scriptures, the presence of a strong esoteric allegory and symbolism. Another of its objects is to prove that the key of interpretation as furnished by the Eastern Hindu-Buddhistic canon of occultism, fitting as well the Christian Gospels as it does archaic Egyptian, Greek, Chaldean, Persian, and even Hebrew mosaic works, have been one common to all the nations, however divergent may have been their respective methods and exoteric blinds. Now, for dear HPB, once you read a couple of sentences of hers, I think you have to paraphrase them because of the style in which she writes. What she's saying is that there is a collection, a group of symbols and allegories found all over the world in all of the religions of the world. They need to be interpreted, and they are interpreted by certain keys, which are also universal. And that when you use these keys to interpret those symbols and allegories, the result is certain exoteric systems or blinds, B-L-I-N-D-S, blinds. Now, the ancient wisdom is, in fact, that universal esoteric allegory and symbolism with its key of interpretation that HPB writes of. And this is a very important point. So, like Robert Frost, I tell you, pay attention to it. The ancient wisdom is not a body of explicit teachings about reincarnation, karma, root races, globes, rounds, chains, planes, principles, bodies, and so on. All of those ideas that are widely associated and identified with theosophy. Those teachings are important, they are useful, and for many of us, very interesting. They've occupied the attention of theosophists for over 120 years now, and quite properly so. They are the content of modern theosophy, but they are not the ancient wisdom. Modern theosophy is itself not one thing, but many things, as theosophy has been articulated for various people under various circumstances since 1875. There is not one modern theosophy, but many. Moreover, none of these varieties of modern theosophy is identical with the ancient wisdom, although it is also sometimes called theosophy. But it needs to be distinguished from all of its contemporary formulations. Perhaps we might call that theosophy, which is identical with the ancient wisdom, timeless theosophy. The ancient wisdom, or timeless theosophy, has had many expressions through human history and has many even today, and it has to be understood in one or another of those expressions. Maybe an analogy will make this thing I'm saying clearer. Suppose I go into an ice cream shop and I order a dish of ice cream, and the clerk is likely to say under those circumstances, "What flavor would you like?" Now suppose I say to the clerk, "Oh, listen, I don't want any flavor. I just want straight ice cream, the real stuff." What's the clerk going to do? Well, probably nothing, because there isn't any ice cream apart from flavors. It only comes in flavors. You have to have vanilla or strawberry or mango or chocolate. You can't have just straight ice cream because there isn't any. Or to use a different analogy, human beings, you and I, exist. But we exist only as members of some ethnic group or some mixture of ethnic groups. We are Aborigines or Africans, Chinese, Europeans, or Indians, or Australians or Americans. All of these ethnic varieties are human beings, expressions of one species with a genetic structure that unites them. But they are all different in genes and in culture. If a man from Mars arrives on a flying saucer and says, "Show me a human being, not any of those Aborigines or Chinese or Africans or Europeans or Indians or Australians or Americans, just a regular human being," we'd have to try to explain to him that regular human beings don't exist. They exist only in specific types. Human beings come only in ethnic varieties. And so the ancient wisdom comes only in various expressions. It is the Hellenic mysteries, it is Taoism, it is Gnosticism, it is Freemasonry, it is modern theosophy, and it is a great many other things. Modern theosophy, then, is like an ethnic group of humanity or a flavor of ice cream. In fact, I don't know what ethnic group of humanity it might be like, but I know what flavor of ice cream it is. It's chocolate. All the expressions of the ancient wisdom, however, share something analogous to whatever it is that makes ice cream, despite its separate flavors, or indeed, something analogous to the genetic structure that marks human beings as a single species. And what is that commonality? What is it that all expressions of the ancient wisdom have in common? What is the ancient wisdom itself as distinct from any of its expressions? The ancient wisdom, I believe, is what Blavatsky was talking about in that short passage I read you from Volume 3 of The Sacred Doctrine. It is not a body of teachings, but is rather allegory and symbolism, or rather the eternal archetypes that lie behind allegories and symbols, together with a way of relating such esoteric archetypes to exoteric concepts like theosophical teachings about reincarnation, the globes, human principles, and so on. If we mistake one specific set of teachings for the ancient wisdom, we are mistaking the letter for the spirit. The ancient wisdom is not limited to any single formulation of it, not even our favorite one, just as ice cream is not limited to any flavor, not even our favorite. The ancient wisdom is by definition something esoteric, and therefore very powerful. When the ancient wisdom is experienced directly, not just through a system of concepts, but directly, it is transformative. It changes the person who experiences it. It is not an idea. It is a force. Now, this way of looking at the ancient wisdom and theosophy may seem slightly heterodox to some of you, but I think it's exactly what H.P. Blavatsky tells us if we read her carefully. It's the message in some notes taken by a student of hers named Bowen on how to study theosophy and particularly The Secret Doctrine, her big book. It was also proposed 24 years ago by Hugh Sherman in an article called Theosophical Ontologies. The editor of the magazine, The Theosophist, where that article appeared, when it was published, said that it would be regarded as controversial and, quote, upsetting to settled views of one sort or another. Sherman's view is that what we ordinarily think of and view as theosophy is an exoteric statement of esoteric truth, or in Blavatsky's terms, it is a blind. All exoteric expressions of esoteric reality being blinds. It further says that esoteric truth can be and has been expressed by a wide variety of exoteric formulations, of which modern theosophy is one directed to our time. Because modern theosophy has been explicitly formulated for us and our culture, it is a statement that we receive with great respect and treasure for its value. But we must not mistake it for the timeless theosophy or the ancient wisdom, which is no body of teachings, but rather a complex of archetypes expressed in symbols with a key for their interpretation as particular teachings. HPB has given us several statements of the keys we need in order to interpret the symbols of the ancient wisdom. One of these is a well-known statement in the secret doctrine called the Three Fundamental Propositions, with which many of you will be familiar. Those propositions can be encapsulated in three catchwords: oneness, or the unity of all being; orderliness, or the cyclical pattern of the universe; and purpose, or the progressive growth toward a goal. Another of HPB's statements of the keys is a list of four basic ideas in those notes taken by Bowen, which I mentioned earlier. They might be summarized as follows. First, there is only one reality in existence, but it has two aspects, consciousness and substance. Second, all matter is alive. Third, human nature corresponds to the great universe as a microcosm to the macrocosm. And four, the universe is organized both as a hierarchy of authority and responsibility, and as a network of equality. That fourth basic idea, which HBB calls the Great Hermetic Axiom, is said to sum up and to synthesize the other four. Its poetic statement is therefore worth keeping in mind. This is the way it was expressed. As is the inner, so is the outer. As is the great, so is the small. As it is above, so it is below. There is but one life and law, and he that worketh it is one. Nothing is inner, nothing is outer, nothing is great, nothing is small, nothing is high, nothing is low in the divine economy. That's a very profound statement, I would suggest to you, a very important key for interpreting things. It says, on the one hand, that the universe is articulated into things which are connected by correspondences within a hierarchy where there are priorities. And on the other hand, that the hierarchy does not exist, that there is simply uniform, universal connections. Both statements are true, however contradictory they may seem. Well, statements like the three fundamental propositions and the four basic ideas are not the ancient wisdom itself, but they are the keys which can relate that wisdom to its exoteric formulations, including theosophy. Hugh Sherman has expressed the central key, which is the first in both of HPB's statements, as follows. The principle or aspect of human nature, which alone gives us value and significance, is beyond that mind in us which creates systems, which depends on other people's descriptions, or is concerned with comparing one teaching disadvantageously with another. Though we are still only momentarily conscious of it here, that which unites humanity is one life which lives through all things. Theosophy is discovered by letting that life consciously and expressively take over our lives. Aristotle said of the ancient mysteries, which were another form of the ancient wisdom, that they were not a matter of learning anything, but rather of experiencing and of being changed by the experience. The ancient mysteries, the Hellenic mysteries, had no content, no intellectual content. They were not instruction given. Rather, they were an experience, and a transformative one. Real theosophy is thus a present-day mystery. Theosophy provides us with a great many things to learn. It's a rich source of information about the hidden side of things, expressed in various ontologies or views of the way the world is. But theosophy is not really any of that information we can learn. It is instead a way of experiencing esoteric allegory and symbolism and of being changed by the experience. There are then four levels to keep in mind. The first level is that of the ancient wisdom or timeless theosophy, which is a complex of archetypal symbols and allegories that speak to the human soul in the voice of the silence. We cannot state it directly any more than we can point to a particular person and say, here is the human species. For each person is a representative of our species rather than the species itself. The second level consists of the keys of interpretation, which permit us to formulate and understand the archetypes. They are the fundamental principles by which we make sense out of our experience, both our experience of the world around us and our experience of the world within us. The third level comprises particular formulations or statements, which are our exoteric systems of belief. The fourth level is a way of life which leads us to experience the archetypes behind the formulations and the principles. The way of life is structured by one or another of the exoteric belief systems, as explicated by the keys of interpretation, and further it leads us to be changed or transformed by our experience. We cannot do without exoteric blinds or public teachings. The ancient wisdom gets expressed in every age in terms of the pervasive thought patterns of that age. And that expression is the basis for a way of life that is appropriate to the time, but also leads us to the timeless experience behind the exoteric statement. Now, if we look to the past, we can see certain dominant metaphors, which are public statements of these archetypes. Such metaphors include the journey or the quest, the test, the marriage, the tree of life, and many others. Two such metaphors are worth looking at carefully because of their importance and impact on human thinking throughout millennia. They are both metaphors for cosmic order, the unified and purposeful structure of the world. The first of those dominant metaphors is that the universe is a great human being, a colossal person. This is the image of the microcosm-macrocosm. We find this metaphor in such diverse human cultures as the Indic, the Norse, and the Hebrew. Let's look briefly at three expressions of it. First, the Mundaka Upanishad tells of an archetypal person, or Purusha, who became the victim for a sacrifice in which his body was divided up. From his mouth came the priestly caste, the talkers, the chattering classes of ancient India. They represent the individuality on the higher mental plane. From his arms came the warrior caste, the doers, representing the personality on the lower mental plane. From his thighs came the artisan class, the makers, representing the desire nature on the astral plane. From his feet came the servant caste, the supporters, representing material nature of the physical plane. Thus, all human beings are part of this primordial person. Similarly, Norse mythology tells of Ymir, an archetypal giant whose body was formed from the rime frost and who was divided up by three brother gods, Odin, Willy, and Wé, into parts from which they made the cosmos. The three gods represent creative wisdom, will, and action, or, as the Theosophical Glossary says, the three forces of separation, formation, and growth or evolution. Of Ymir's flesh, these gods made the land or physical plane. From his blood, they made the seas or lower emotional plane. Of his hair, the trees or devotion to the of higher mental plane, emotional plane. Of his skull, they made the heavens or mental plane. Of his eyebrows, they made the earth on which humanity dwells or the causal plane. And of his brains, they made the clouds or the Buddhic plane. Again, the cosmic person is divided into parts which become the basis of the universe. The Hebrew Kabbalah speaks of Adam Kadmon, the archetypal or heavenly man, whose body contains the 10 sephirot, and who is the prototype of all that exists. His body occupies the space extending from the earth to the firmament, and he is the macrocosm, the pattern for the generation of each of us. Adam Kadmon represents the manifested third logos, the universe, as a living entity. Now, all three of these versions of the cosmic person are unlocked by the same keys of interpretation. They say that the multifarious universe is one thing in origin, that everything in it is related to everything else, as the organs of our body are related in a total system, that the purpose of the universal order is to serve as a model or source for everything that makes it up, that the universe is a living entity, and that a pattern of correspondences connects the great order of the universe with the little order of our lives. This metaphorical image of the great person, the cosmic giant, the primordial human, has been an extremely powerful one in the history of human thought. The second of the dominant metaphors seems, at first glance, to be very different, and perhaps a bit alien to the values which many of us would like to hold. It says that the universe is a gigantic machine, such as a clock. It's a newer metaphor than that of the human form, but it's still quite old. In classical times, the Ptolemaic view of the world represented it as a great mechanical work, in which revolving crystalline spheres were fixed one inside the other, each being the setting for one of the planets or of the stars. They turned like clockwork in a gigantic machine, intermeshing and keeping cosmic time. At the center of this immense machine was the Earth, the lowest and densest thing in the universe. At the circumference of the machine was the subtlest sphere of all, that of the prima mobile, or the first movable, which was turned by God, the first mover, and which caused all the lower spheres to revolve. As the spheres revolved, each one gave off a distinctive note, and all those notes blended together to produce a perfect harmony, the music of the spheres. This image of the music-producing cosmic machine, a kind of immense music box, became extremely influential in medieval, Renaissance, and even more recent times. In our own century, the English composer Gustav Holst was still drawing on this archetypal image in his composition, The Planets. During the Age of Reason, the universe was regarded as a great clock and God as the clockmaker, who made the machine, wound it up, set it running, and thereafter ceased to be concerned with it. The image of the universe as a complex machine has appealed greatly to the scientific and technical minded, emphasizing the order and system of the universe. To the exclusion of some of the other keys, it seems incompatible with the metaphor of the human fact, a human form. But in fact, the two metaphors have often been combined. Human beings have sometimes been thought of as merely machines. So Charles Dickens exclaimed upon the mysteries of this machine called man. And in George Bernard Shaw's Arms and the Man, one of the characters complains of another, "You're not a man, you're a machine." The problem with machines is that they are unintelligent and soulless. However, the mechanistic view of human beings is not limited to literary convention. It goes back to classical philosophers like Democritus and Epicurus and extends to an English philosopher like Thomas Hobbes. More recently, behaviorist psychologists such as B.F. Skinner have have viewed all behavior as physical responses to stimuli from the environment, giving rise to operant conditioning, as it's called, by which human beings are supposed to be controlled, just as a machine is programmed. Well, if human beings have sometimes been regarded as machines, the tables have also been returned, and machines have been treated as though they were human, although often with a strange lack of certain characteristics judged to be illogical, albeit quintessentially human. The robot, a word which is from Czech, where it meant forced labor, was coined to name human-like machines. Data, the humanoid robot on Star Trek, The Next Generation. Have you all did, is this television program shown around? Yes, good. Data is one of the favorite and sympathetic characters of that science fiction program. On the other hand, HAL, in 2001, is a humanoid machine gone berserk. A major interest of many computer scientists has been the development of AI, or artificial intelligence, the ability of a computer to react appropriately to unforeseen circumstances. There was a mathematician by the name of Alan Turing, who was a cryptographer during World War II. In fact, he broke the Japanese code during World War II, and Tom Stoppard has written a perfectly delightful play about him, which I recommend to you if it comes around. Alan Turing invented the concept of an ideal machine whose responses to stimuli are so appropriate that someone who cannot see the machine would not be able to tell whether it was a machine or a human person. Computer technologists have long been trying to realize that idea as an actual Turing machine, which could pass the Turing test of fooling a human communicator into thinking it was human. A contest has been established called the Leibniz Prize Competition in Artificial Intelligence. It is intended to identify the computer program that can best pass the Turing test. The third competition, held in December 1993, had eight judges, each of whom spent 3 hours communicating through eight computer terminals with either a human being or a computer program that was written to discuss a particular subject, such as pets, baseball, or abortion. I'm going to read you two short extracts from conversations with an unknown partner. In each case, it's just four exchanges, conversational exchanges. One of the conversations is with a machine, and the other is with a human being. See if you can tell which is which. First one. Judge, hello, what kind of pets do you have yourself? Answer, I have two cats. Judge, what are their names? Answer, my cats are called Spats and Bowtie. Judge, how do you feel about declawing? Answer, what kind of pets did you have as a child? Judge, won't you answer my question? How do you feel about declawing? Answer, guinea pigs are about as smart as cucumbers. Second exchange. Judge, what team are you a fan of? Answer, the Baltimore Orioles. Judge, have you always been an Orioles fan? Answer, I'd like to say yes, but at one time when I was small, I was a Tiger fan. Judge, didn't what's-his-name Robinson play third base for the Orioles? Answer, you have that right. The best ever to play third base. Judge, what was his first name? Answer, Brooks, of course. Which is a machine, which is a human being? It shouldn't be difficult, whether or not you know anything about cats or baseball, to recognize that the first conversation was with a computer, programmed to respond to key words and sentence types, which had to fall back on irrelevancies when faced with an unpredictable situation. The programmer had forgotten to program in declawing. So the program was stuck. On the other hand, the second was with a human being who displayed a personality and appropriate, although unpredictable, responses. Now, none of the eight judges in this competition was fooled into thinking that any of the computers was a human being. On the other hand, 5 of the judges mistook at least one human being for a computer. That is, computers cannot successfully pass as humans, but humans can pass for machines. A machine may be a metaphor for a human being and the world, but the reverse doesn't work. Certain aspects of a human being are machine-like, but nothing about the machine is really human. This suggests a bon mot of Krishnamurti's, who said, "The only thing a computer cannot do compared to a human being is to look into the evening sky." Now, at this point, you are probably wondering what all this has to do with the ancient wisdom, or perhaps even whether you have not actually been listening to a Turing machine yourself. But there is a connection. For the machine metaphor for cosmic and human order has recently undergone an unexpected transformation into the computer, the internet, and the information superhighway. And they, let me suggest to you, are stunning metaphors for the order of the cosmos and of human nature. The information superhighway is a projected system of communication linking computers and related forms of electronic storage and retrieval by optical fiber cables and other connections into a worldwide network. Although still a project, it is clearly realizable and represents a great evolutionary leap in communication. Al Gore, Vice President of the United States, has claimed and been credited with the most popular name for this great system, namely information superhighway. Variations on the term are also popular, such as Infobahn and I-way. I for information, but with an obvious pun. It is also called cyberspace, with a different metaphor. A forerunner of the vaporish, it's sometimes referred to as vaporware. Those who are into computers will know there is hardware, right, which is the actual machines. There's software, which is the programs that run through the machines. And then there's vaporware. Vaporware is ideas people got that haven't come to anything yet. A forerunner of the vaporish information superhighway that is solid is the internet, a connection of thousands of computer networks across the globe. The internet is a real technology with enormous potential for assisting communication and thus linkage between people throughout the world. It's a metaphor with great implications. Think for a moment about what computers are. They have two aspects, both of which are essential, both of which I have just mentioned. One is, on the one hand, a computer is just a heap of machinery, a keyboard, a screen, a central unit with wires and chips and boards and other mysterious innards, through all of which electricity flows. That is its hardware. On the other hand, the computer is also a system of instructions or programs that direct the flow of electricity through the hardware. That's its software. The software is really not a thing at all. It's a pattern of impulses that controls electrical energy. It takes very little imagination to see that in the computer we have a close analog to the human constitution. The hardware is our body, or our bodies if we think of the emotions in the mind and intuition as material stuff. The electricity that flows through the hardware is like the prana or jiva, the vital energy that flows through our bodies. Just as the electricity doesn't belong to the hardware of the computer, but just flows through it, so the vital energy of life does not belong to us, but only flows through us. Electricity and jiva are both universal forces, forms of fohat, that we use, but that are not ours. The software programs that run the hardware are like our soul or consciousness. And like software, the soul is no thing, but a pattern of impulses that control the energy directing the body. Norbert Wiener, the father of cybernetics, a discipline that compares our brain and nervous system to the electronic system of a computer, said that human beings are not stuff that abides, but patterns that perpetuate themselves. That is a very Buddhistic and a very theosophical statement. Our souls and consciousness are patterns that perpetuate themselves. They are our software. Hardware and software have to work together. Neither is any good alone. If you have the most advanced hardware made, but no software, it doesn't do anything. It just sits there inert. Electricity may flow through it, but it accomplishes nothing. Hardware without software. Still don't do anything by themselves. One more element is needed. Someone has to sit at the keyboard and enter instructions. That someone has to watch the monitor to see what the results are and to continue giving input at the appropriate times in appropriate ways. There has to be a computer operator. That operator is an analog of the self, or the Atma, in us. It flips the switch that starts the electricity flowing. It chooses the software to use. It selects the hardware to receive it. It starts everything. It controls everything. And everything is done for it. So the computer is really just a big metaphor for us, body, soul, and spirit. But it doesn't stop there, for there is also one another through the computer. What we have here is a little network, a little office network. Now imagine that several offices in different parts of the city of Sydney also need to be linked together. So each office, or each computer in the office, has a modem, which is a machine that hooks the computer into a telephone line and translates computer information into a form that can be sent over the telephone line to another modem in another computer. Now we have a number of offices, each of which is a little communication network linked together in a big Sydney-wide communication network. Now next imagine that this bigger network also gets linked by modems and telephone lines to other cables to other similar networks in Brisbane, Melbourne, Canberra, Perth, and elsewhere. Now we have an all Australia network of networks of networks. And that's connected with similar networks in New Zealand, America, England, Russia, Japan, Chile, Nigeria, and so on. Finally, there is a global network of many networks inside networks, a cloud. Actually, that's what it's called in computer technology. The internet is called a cloud. It is a cloud or aura of networks. That's the internet. It's possible, once you are connected with the internet, to be in touch with people on the other side of the world and to communicate with them by sending messages through the amazingly complex labyrinth of the internet. Your message doesn't go directly to the person you send it to. It's relayed through multiple channels of the internet at lightning speed. The internet is a hierarchy of connections that enables the great democracy of networking. And what is it an analog of? We are individuals, you and I, each at our own separate bodily computers, hardware and software, functioning by the universal electric power, and controlled by the real us, the spiritual operator, which is our highest self. But we are also all linked together in an amazing hierarchy of connections that finally allows each of us to be in touch with every other. And that is the great hermetic axiom, a network of connections through a hierarchical structure. The Theosophical Society itself is one network, but it's also linked on the inner planes with other network, all together composing our planetary spiritual internet. members of the society subscribe to the great internet through the society's network. We have linked our workstations together in this particular nucleus. But through it, we are connected with a network that has no limits, for we are joined with a network of cosmic life and purpose. The computer, and thus the internet, works with highly abstract signals, electrical impulses of positive and negative forces arranged in amazingly complex patterns. They are esoteric symbols or allegories, as it were. The particular application or program used is a key that translates those abstract symbols into something you and I can recognize, that is, into an exoteric system. And so we're back with the ancient wisdom, the keys of interpretation, and the exoteric systems of belief. Information is what the universe is. Information is that which informs us. Information is that which gives form in us. The whole cosmos is just information. The cosmos is God's conversation with himself. It is God's way of informing himself. And we are the workstations through which he sends his messages. The information superhighway, the internet, and the computer are a contemporary and an almost perfect metaphor for the ancient wisdom and the network of human beings who realize it. This metaphor combines the mechanical and the human metaphor, which have been so powerful in human history, and it incorporates yet another great metaphor, that of the path. The information superhighway which we travel is the universe, but it is also we who do the traveling. The pilgrim, the path, and the journey are all one. As the voice of the silence puts it, thou canst not travel on that path before thou hast become the path itself. Well, now, I promised you a conclusion, right? An end. So let me reach that. I've tried to make a number of points. Being a theosophist, I'm going to say there were seven of them. The first is that the ancient wisdom is the accumulated insight of our race, and as such, it is archetypal and cannot be communicated directly, but is expressed in symbols that have to be interpreted by certain universal principles or keys. Second, the interpretation of those symbols produces exoteric systems of beliefs, teachings, blinds. Third, modern theosophy is one exoteric system designed for our times. Four, modern theosophy is itself not a single system, not one homogeneous system, but a complex, a network, or a cloud of related systems generated as various theosophists have attempted to articulate the system of theosophy for themselves and others. Five, we experience the ancient wisdom only through particular systems, metaphors, and symbols. These must constantly be adapted to our times. As society changes, so must our metaphors. Six, certain metaphors have been extremely powerful, such as those of the cosmic person and the cosmic machine. Seven, contemporary technology has produced a new metaphorical complex. The computer, the internet, and the information superhighway. No single metaphor works for everyone. If the information superhighway doesn't work for you, throw it away. But we need various metaphors and various systems because people differ in their needs. The ancient wisdom is ancient, timeless, and unchanging. But the expression of that wisdom must be contemporary, timely, and ever adapting to the age. Welcome to the information superhighway. Have a good journey.